Transmitter device activated. Coordinates set for Earth 2.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Earth 2 podcast, your weekly exploration of the DC Comics multiverse and the legacy of their Golden Age characters through the Silver and the Bronze Ages of comics. I'm one half of your dream team, Peter Watson.
And I'm your worst nightmare, I'm David Steele. Welcome back, thank you for joining us. Peter is still with us, listeners. Round of applause for Parade.
For the time being.
Oh, it's a good one this week, listeners. I'm really excited about us doing this episode. Reading this comic again was an absolute delight. I'm really, really excited. Are you quite excited about doing this one, Peter?
I'm very excited about doing this one. Yes, I'm very glad that I remembered about it.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. Obviously, you know, we cover the legacy of the Golden Age characters, and the way we've sort of established legacy is the use of character names. You might have enjoyed our episodes where we dealt with Manhunters or Wasps or Fiddlers or such like.
Or the Misters Who.
Yes, the Misters Who. I listened to that again, actually, just the other week.
Really?
Glorious. Ross's Mister Who is just hilarious. Anyway, and also, listeners, I'm sure if you're a long-term listener, you'll have enjoyed our episode on the Silver Age Starmen, one of our earliest ones and another real favourite of ours to do. Mm-hmm. This week, we are dealing with the legacy of another member of the Justice Society of America.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, to get straight to the point, we're doing issue one of the 1970s version of The Sandman,
Yeah. Published
on the 2nd of January, 1974. Joe Simon and Jack Kirby, who previously, back in the day, had done some work on The Adventures of Wesley Dodds and Sandy, when the Sandman had got rid of his fedora and taken on the purple and yellow spandex.
Mm-hmm.
And we shall say not too much more about that at the moment, because there is another story we'll be covering fairly soon that we'll be dealing with all of that.
Mm.
But this is a new version of the Sandman.
Yes.
Which seemed to come around because Joe Simon was back working at DC Comics. Previous to this, he'd obviously done Brother Power the Geek. He'd been involved with the series Prez. Prez will also be appearing in the podcast before too long. Mm-hmm. He'd done Champion Sports alongside Jerry Grandinetti, who'd worked on The Spectre, obviously, previously.
Mm-hmm.
And Jack Kirby himself was obviously working at DC by this point, because the New Gods stuff had begun, the Fourth World, the Jimmy Olsen material, which we discussed at length roughly this time last year.
Yep.
But this is a new one, which just seems to have come about, because from what we can gather, Joe Simon had the idea of him and Jack doing a new version of The Sandman. Really?
How exciting.
By all accounts, Joe and Jerry Grandinetti did the layouts and stuff, and then Kirby and his mob apparently finished the artwork. It's a fascinating one. We've got a lot to say about this once we've read the story, and a lot to talk about. Peter, do you want to tell everyone about the cover to issue one of the 70s Sandman?
This is a very Kirby bombastic cover.
Yes.
It is superb. We have, at the top, a lovely Sandman logo. It's quite straightforward. Actually, it reminds me a bit of The Shadow for some reason.
Yes, I know what you mean.
A cross between The Shadow and Superman.
Yes, I understand that. I would agree. That's very perceptive, yes.
And at the top, we've got DC, the line of superstars, in the top left corner. He's back, the man who brought you all these wonderful stories and horrible dreams, The Sandman. 20 cents, number one, winter issue.
Yes.
Now, the main image on the cover, it's a lovely blue cover, but I believe there are some variants to this cover.
Yes, a sort of purple sort of variant, I believe it's called.
Yeah, it seems to be some sort of thing with the printing process, depending on how far into the printing run it was. It's not an official variant,
yeah. But
there is some colour discolouration on it. So I'm reading from a blue cover. What are you reading from?
I am also reading from a blue cover. And it's interesting we mention this because there's an issue of West Coast Avengers quite soon after the Lost in Space Time story with Mockingbird on the cover, which I have two versions of.
Oh, really?
One's a sort of brown, one's a sort of darker.
Mm.
So it must be a similar sort of thing, I think, of the ink running out.
Interesting.
Did I mention that when I was in France recently, I bought an issue of the French series Titans that reprinted a chapter of the West Coast Avengers Lost in Space Time with a new cover? Did I mention that at any point? Did I tell you about that?
I don't think I have, but there you go. Yes, you've mentioned it now.
But I mentioned it now. Anyway, back to the plot.
So, in the background, there's some hideous monster-type creatures. All creatures from the Ids, you might say. There's like a big snake creature. There's horrible guy who's basically just got a hideous face with arms coming out of it almost. There's a brutish character. There's a globular character.
I see what you did there.
There's a guy who's got mostly a human face, but he seems to have a big dome with electronics at the top of his head.
Yes.
My goodness, it's horrible. And all these things look as if they're preying on a sleeping boy.
Mm.
But don't worry, folks. These horrible things aren't going to get this boy because our hero, the Sandman, is jumping at us in a very dynamic Jack Kirby way.
Absolutely.
And he's saying,
"Come see what weirdies I've dreamed up for you."
And the Sandman looks like nothing you've seen before. He's got kind of a yellow tunic and leggings, similar to the Wesley Dodds Sandman from when Joe and Jack did that back in the 40s. But rather than purple being the other colour, red is the predominant colour here. Mm. He's got red boots, red shorts, red gloves, a massive red cape, a red cowl coming up with a yellow motif going around it.
Mm.
It looks unlike anything we've really seen. It feels very throwbacky to the 40s.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It's almost like a kind of caricature version of what a superhero costume should look like. A very heightened sort of unreal version of what a superhero costume might look like.
Almost like a child's dream of what a superhero costume might look like.
Yes, possibly.
Mm.
Gosh, that's a say, we've got so much to say on this one, we really do. Shall we just jump straight in?
Oh yes, let's do it.
Deep breath, listeners, deep breath. Right, now, obviously, this is 70s Jack Kirby. I'm kind of take it or leave it with 70s Jack Kirby. Some stuff I like, some stuff I don't. I remember a couple of years ago trying to read The Eternals and giving up around about issue 5 or issue 6 because it was just, I found it almost impenetrable. But then, obviously, we've covered some of his Jimmy Olsen stuff, and that's quite, you know, larger than life's probably the word for it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you're all familiar with some of the work he did in Captain America a couple of years or so after this. So it's basically, what I'm trying to say here is we're going to do our best to try and do it justice. I'd encourage you to track down a copy of this or to dig up your copy of the hardcover reprint of the Jack Kirby, Joe Simon, Sandman stuff, because this issue is reprinted at the end of it.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe if you've got one of the Jack Kirby omnibuses that DC have published in recent years. I would encourage you to read along with this if you can. We will probably not do it justice in as much as the describing the visuals, but we will do our best. So we begin with a six-panel grid on the first page. The caption for the first panel reads,
"Almost within sight of Cape Kennedy, the reefs of Dolphin Island stand like giant tombstones over the corpses of the men and ships that perished in the treacherous waters of the South Atlantic."
Yes, we see in this first panel a stormy sea with lightning rending the sky and rocky outcrops popping up out of the sea. And we can see, if you pardon the repetition, we can see a large ship in trouble. Caption for panel 2.
"The population of Dolphin Island consists of old Ezra Paulson, his fishing boats, and his grandson Jed, a spindly lad racked by an asthmatic wheezing cough. On this windswept moonless night, young Jed sleeps uneasily, tormented by his dreams."
Yes, and we see Jed, he's obviously the kid that Peter described on the cover, a small boy, kind of strawberry blonde hair. And we see him asleep on his pillow. And it's almost the suggestion is that this boat that's being tossed around in the sea is in his dream. We can see the boat. It's almost like it's floating above him. There's a slight hint of a flashback ripple type cloud effect going on as if this is what Jed is picturing. In panel 3, we see the image of a man in the water hovering almost above. It's almost like it's a projection above Jed's head, what he's imagining, what he's dreaming. A man floating in the water and clutching a doll that kind of looks like a cross between the Impossible Man and the Thing,
mm-hmm.
in as much as it's purple with green skin, but the green skin has a sort of rocky sort of feel to it.
Kind of Skrull-like.
Yeah, touch of that. The man floating in the water is yelling,
"Help! Save me!"
And then he continues in panel 4.
"Air! Precious air! Can't breathe!"
And it's obvious that Jed is struggling in his sleep. He's uncomfortable. He's maybe moving around. We can see the man trying to keep above water, but only managed to keep his hand above, holding this weird green and purple doll. We're still only in the first page. The caption for panel 5 reads,
"In an adjoining room, old Ezra is awakened by his grandson's cries."
Yes, you see old Ezra, old man, thick white beard, thick white hair, wearing a orange nightshirt, sitting up in bed, and we can hear a voice, presumably it's Jed's voice, drifting through the door.
"Can't breathe."
Final panel, page 1. Granddad has got up, go through to Jed's room to see how his grandson's doing, and Jed is again almost moaning in his sleep.
"Can't breathe."
How appropriate, given Peter's current issues with his respiratory system. We turn the page and, oh my goodness. It's a two-page spread, essentially. There's a massive panel that takes up the top half, or top two-thirds, really, of the whole image. A caption reads,
"Somewhere between heaven and earth, there is a place where dreams are monitored. This is the domain of a legendary figure, eternal and immortal, who shares with man and beast all the secrets of the ages. He is The Sandman.
And we see the word Sandman almost as if they've been carved out of the rock that the boat in Jed's dream has now crashed into. We can see also in front of this large rock with Sandman written into it, we can see the sailor clinging onto another rock that's poking out of the sea. Another caption gives us the credits for this issue.
A special treat by a special trio. Edited and drawn by Jack Kirby. Script by Joe Simon. Lettered and inked by Mike Royer.
Now, here's where I have to try and do it justice. The rest of this opening image that takes up the vast majority of the spread, it gives us the suggestion that the Sandman logo and the ship in the water are being viewed on a screen by the Sandman figure that Peter described on the cover. Yes, his costume is yellow and red. We can see the detailing in his gloves and his belt, collar, the cape. He's operating what looks like an outrageously fantastical Reed Richards style bit of equipment, but he's surrounded by screens. There are some smaller screens showing a close-up of someone's face and a couple of other screens showing a monster and what looks like a winged figure. There's another screen above him showing this boat tossing and turning in the ocean. In front of him, attached to the machinery, is a sign that reads Universal Dream Monitor. And behind him are two large glass cases, for want of a better way of putting it, that are labelled and occupied by two figures. The first one is labelled Brute and is occupied by a large humanoid figure with very indelicate features. There's a touch of the Thing, a touch of the Hulk too in a way, but he's sort of coloured a sort of pinkish grey. And in front of him, in a much smaller glass canister that is labelled Glob, there's what looks like basically a head with feet and arms. And it's gross with exaggerated eyebrows and a huge mouth and huge eyes and a very squat, squared off nose. He's also coloured kind of pink and brown. The Sandman is holding a green, what looks like a twisted car aerial or a bit of something, bit of kit. It almost looks like a microphone or something.
He's a secret podcaster.
Yes. And he's holding this as he's speaking and he's saying, "Thought transference completed. Now to push the awake switch. Wake up, Jed. Wake up." And then we cut back to Jed and his grandpa. Jed sits bolt upright in his bed saying,
"Grandpa, a man is drowning. Out on the reefs, I saw it so clearly."
"It was a dream, Jed. Only a dream." In the next panel, Jed has got up and got dressed. He's put on his waterproofs. He's put on his boots. He's saying,
"No, I saw. It was real. We got to help him."
"Easy, Jed. That asthma of yours will start acting up again if you don't calm down." The next panel, Jed's put on his yellow waterproof coat and hat, and he's going out the door into the weather saying,
"No, we got to help him."
"Come back, you little fool. Wait for me," calls Grandad behind him. The next panel, we see they're both outside. There's rain coming down and the sea boiling around them. And they've gone down to the rocks. And we can see the sailor clinging onto the rock that we saw in Jed's dream. Jed points and says,
"There, you see, it's true."
And the poor sailor is saying,
"Help me."
The final panel of page 3, we can see Grandpa Ezra reaching down and grabbing the sailor by the wrist, thank goodness, saying, "Hang on, sailor, we'll have you ashore in a jiffy." Caption for the first panel of page 4 reads,
"With all his strength, the old man fights the raging sea for the struggling sailor and wins. But it is a hollow victory. On the shore, the battered, water-soaked figure gasps his last breath."
Yes, we can see that Jed and Ezra have stretched out the poor man in the grass. He's holding up the little green, scaly-skinned doll towards Jed and he's saying,
"The Webberlink. Take the Webberlink, boy. Don't let it fall into their hands."
The next panel, we see a very moody shot of Grandpa Ezra and Jed looking down. As Grandpa Ezra says, "He's dead. It's real strange him hanging on to that ugly doll through all this."
"He called it the Werblink, Grandpa. I like it. I don't think it's ugly."
A slow dissolve. Caption for panel 3.
Little Jed never had anything to love. His parents died at sea before he could remember them, and because of his asthma, he couldn't have a pet. Not until now. Now he has the Werblink.
Yes, some time has obviously passed. We see Grandpa Ezra in a fine sailor's cap and a big woolly jumper, repairing a net. Jed is standing in the background playing with the Werblink doll. Grandpa Ezra says, "It's creepy. That's what it is. I wish you'd get rid of it. Boys don't play with dolls."
"It's not a doll, Grandpa. The Werblink is my friend. It's like a human friend."
"The Werblink is always at Jed's side. In the daytime, the two play together. At night, they share the same bed."
Yes, and panel 4 shows Grandpa Ezra looking in on Jed as asleep in his bed, with the Werblink on the pillow beside him. It almost looks so the Werblink is looking up at Ezra. You can see behind it, Ezra's standing there. Ezra's thinking, "Ugly. Ugly. I don't know what it is about that ugly doll. I have the feeling that he resents me. He's mocking me. And another slow dissolve.
Then Jed dreams a deep, disturbing dream.
The werblink in this image in the final panel of page 4 has grown to massive size, slightly larger than human, and we can see it chasing Grandpa Ezra through a very rocky landscape. Jed is there too, and he's yelling,
"Don't hurt him, werblink! Run, Grandpa, run!"
And as he runs away from the werblink, Grandpa Ezra cries, "No! No! Stay away from me!" Caption for the first panel then on page 5 reads,
"At that moment on the Sandman's dream screen..."
Yes, we're back in the Sandman's weird control room that we saw in the opening splash spread, and he's watching Jed on the dream screen. There's a sign, actually, there's a notification in front of the Sandman that reads, "Nightmare." So obviously it looks so it's lit up. And on the image, it looks as though Jed has tipped himself into an open crevice or something. Sandman is watching all this and he cries, "A nightmare alert! It's little Jed! He's falling!" In the next panel, we can see that Brute and Glob, the two weird-looking characters in the glass canisters that we described earlier, are also watching what's going on. Glob says,
"Let him fall, Sandman. Let him fall."
"No, you nightmares know what will happen if he hits bottom." From off-camera in the next panel, Brute exclaims, "Let him fall." And Glob again says,
"Let him die."
"Quiet, Glob. You too, Brute. This dream is not in your jurisdiction," says the Sandman, looking very heroic. And the caption for panel 4 reads,
"As the universal master of dreams, the Sandman has the ability to invade Little Jed's nightmare."
Little Jed's nightmare supported the Montrose Avenue in Bristol in 1998. I feel sure we should mention that. This is a great panel. It almost looks as though Sandman is flying from his headquarters into the nightmare. It's like a jagged bolt of yellow light down the middle of the panel that he breaches and flies into the rocky terrain where we saw Jed and his grandpa. In panel 5, we see Jed pitching, falling down into a deep pit, yelling,
"Help! Catch me, somebody!"
And the Sandman flies down, grabs him, arrests his fall, and the final panel of page 5 lifts him back out and flies back out of the pit. Gosh. First panel of page 6 is a shot of Grandpa Ezra, waking up, disturbed, obviously, by the sound of Jed's voice. We hear Jed saying,
"Help! Catch me, somebody!"
And the caption for panel 2 of page 6 then reads,
"At that moment, in little Jed's dream..."
We see Sandman lifting Jed out of the pit, stunning detailing, and this is so Kirby at Hearts, and as he's lifting Jed out, he's saying, "Phew, that was too close, and now it's time for you to awaken. Wake up," he says in this panel, which shows him still holding Jed, shows the Sandman still holding Jed, but then the next panel shows Jed being shaken awake by Grandpa Ezra, who's saying, "Jed, wake up, you've been dreaming."
"Grandpa, the werblink was after you. I was trying to save you when I fell into that deep pit."
"Easy, Jed. Calm down, boy. Everything's just fine now." With that, Grandpa Ezra gives Jed a hug to reassure him. Jed says,
"Oh, Grandpa, it was so scary."
And then we arrive at the top of page 7, where the first caption reads,
"The next night, as Jed sleeps soundly, his grandfather takes the doll from the boy's pillow."
Yes, we see Grandpa Ezra holding up the werblink, and again, it looks as though the werblink is watching him, it's looking at him. We get the detail of its scaly, rocky, green skin, and the bright eyes looking down at Grandpa Ezra, who's saying, "It's your fault. You'll bring nothing but grief to this house."
It seems to the old man there is hate and defiance in the leering doll. Inside himself, he feels the surge of uncontrollable emotion.
Yes, Grandpa Ezra, it's a close-up of the doll, Grandpa Ezra's hand gripping it fiercely, saying, "I'll fix you. I'll fix you for good."
Then he smashes the doll upon the table.
Yes, that's what we see with a couple of pow-pow sound effects. We see him smashing the doll on the table.
The violent act is repeated again and again.
Yes, a massive wham sound effect again as Grandpa Ezra brings the doll down on the table, and the caption for panel 5 reads,
"When the old man's anger is spent, the doll lies broken at his feet."
Yes, and that's what we see. Hand falling off, arms falling off, legs split open. Looks as though actually its insides are almost mechanical. Very interesting. In the next panel, Grandpa Ezra is obviously experiencing regret. He puts a hand up to his head, which I'm miming for the benefit of our YouTube viewers, and he says, "What have I done? What came over me? It's a doll. Only a doll." And he walks away in the final panel of page 7 thinking, "How will I ever explain this insanity to Jed? I've got to get rid of that thing before the boy wakes up." And again we see the head of the werblink lying on the ground, and it almost looks as though it's watching him. I'm going to have bad dreams about the Werblink tonight, I'm telling you.
The Sandman will protect you.
I hope so. I may have to take one of my Wesley Dodd action figures through and set them in my room just to keep to keep me safe. Maybe I'll take all three of them through. Mm. Yeah. The first panel of page 8, take a drink, listeners. We have a full moon looming over the sea. We can see Grandpa Ezra walking along with a spade over his arm and a bag in his hand, which obviously is the remnants of the Werblink. Panel 2, he's digging a hole. Panel 3, he's taken the bag that the Werblink is in. Panel 4, he's dropped it into the hole and he's filling the hole back up with the soil that he's dug up. Panel 5, the Werblink's face is going to give me bad dreams, poking out of the soil. And then, in the final panel of page 8, against another full moon, take another drink. Grandpa Ezra, with a spade in his hand, is saying, "There, that's the end of you. Now maybe our lives will be peaceable again." And a slow dissolve. We turn the page, we arrive at the top of page 9, and a big long caption reads,
"We now take leave of Dolphin Island and trace the route of the Werblink across the Atlantic Ocean, over the continent, then Asia, and finally, Japan, and the man known as General Electric."
Yes, a large caption there, almost as if that's the name of the story.
"In the operating room of a Japanese veterans hospital on the outskirts of Tokyo."
And we see two men, two doctors in surgical scrubs, one of obviously Asian origin. They're both wearing masks. The other man is a white man wearing glasses. They're surrounded by all sorts of technological equipment. We can see some very Jack Kirby style designs and screens. And under a sheet on a table in front of them is obviously a body that they've been working on. The doctor in glasses says,
"Japanese brain surgery has been developed to a remarkable degree, Dr. Masugi. If we'd possessed this knowledge during World War II, many soldiers on both sides would have been saved."
The other doctor replies, "It took many years to gather this knowledge, Dr. Kaufman. Almost 30 years observing and recording the human brain performing miracles."
You said, observing? How could you observe the brain?
In the next panel, they've taken their leave from the surgery room. They're walking along. We can see a nurse to one side and obviously what looks like a military policeman to the other. Dr. Masugi replies, saying, "I speak of the former Japanese general whose head served as a classroom showcase for our scientists, the man now known as General Electric. General Electric was the leader of the Kamikazes, a suicide squadron in the Great War. By some miracle, he survived his crash, although his head was all but destroyed." Listeners, just you wait till you see General Electric in the socials. Oh my God. First panel of page 10, it's like we're seeing the two doctors' faces reflected, maybe in the windows of a doorway or something. Masugi continues, "We rebuilt his entire head with electric devices. Each year, as new electronic products were developed by Japanese research, we have made improvements." And we can see it looks like they've opened a couple of doors into another room, and we see General Electric. Dr. Masugi continues, "Lately, we have installed Japan's finest solid-state circuits in the general's head. It is gratifying to watch this great brain function." And the other doctor says,
"Watch it? I don't understand."
"Come, I will show you. I'm certain the general won't mind." And at this point, I should describe General Electric. Now, he's obviously of Asian descent. There's a slight element of caricature to it. But the top half of his skull is basically like an open glass bowl. And we can see Jack Kirby-style electrical equipment inside. It's obviously, it looks like his brain has been replaced, as Dr. Masugi's been saying, by all of these electronic devices. He seems to be working with tools on a little bit of equipment himself, working on something. We can see what looks like very familiar green scaly skin. Dr. Masugi observes as this is going on, "General Electric enjoys building dolls that walk, talk and do many things. It's excellent therapy," he says, as we see General Electric placing a hand into the arm of a doll, and again it has that green scaly look to it like the Werblink. Dr. Kaufman steps forward in the final panel of page 10 saying,
"Fascinating. May I see it, General?"
And General Electric turns and yells,
"No, do not touch!"
In the first panel of page 11, he repeats this,
"I said, do not touch!"
And as a whap sound effect as he pushes Dr. Kaufman back, Dr. Kaufman says,
"But..."
Interrupted, obviously. In the next panel, Dr. Masugi turns and yells, "Guards! Stop him! He's gone mad!" And two armed military police rush into the room. General Electric stands up, clutching his doll. We can see it's a sort of feminine-looking version of the Werblink, wearing a blue skirt and his black hair. Kind of looks like Granny Goodness.
It does.
As if she was being impersonated by a Skrull.
Yes.
We can see all the bits, the elements for another doll on a table in front of him. And Dr. Masugi says to the military police, "Easy. Just get him under control. He's not dangerous, one of the policemen replies.
I hope you're right, Doctor.
But then the caption of the next panel reads,
but the general is swift as a cobra and does the unexpected.
Yes, with a crash. He leaps out of the window of the room that he's in and escapes the hospital. Dr. Masugi shouts, don't shoot! The general's head is priceless! In the final panel of page 11, Dr. Masugi and one of the MPs have crossed to the window and looked out. Dr. Masugi observes, he's gone. And we are continued on the third page following. Pass a nice contemporary DC subscription advert highlighting some of the 100 pages. Another advertisement for self-defence lessons, very handy. And we arrive at the top of page 12 where the first caption reads,
1 week later, a stray dog sniffs at the mound of earth which covers the remains of little Jed's broken doll.
Yes, we see the dog who, rather adorably, has a patch over his left eye, sniffing at this mound of earth, and we can see a large tick-tick-tick sound effect coming from it. The dog's obviously intrigued. The caption for panel 2 reads,
attracted by a strange ticking sound, the dog begins to dig at the doll's grave.
And that's what we see, and the tick-tick-tick seems to get louder. In panel 3, the dog has dug down enough that the face and the right hand of the werblink has been revealed. In panel 4, the dog is not having it. He's obviously disturbed and scared by the werblink. With a yelp, he runs off, and it almost looks as though the werblink is watching him go. A slow dissolve.
That night, in the Sandman's Dream Dome...
The Dream Dome, that must be where the Sandman's headquarters is, must be what it's called. We see the Sandman in front of a screen, and there's a massive alert, some giant
ding-ding-ding-ding-ding-dings
going off. And on all the screens in front of the Sandman, we see different images of the werblink. It's obviously got out of the ground and it's walking around. Sandman exclaims, the emergency alarm! It's a four-alarm nightmare! I must, of course, mention that four-alarm nightmare supported Menswear when they played the Plaza in Glasgow in 1995.
I've got a bootleg of that gig.
Have you?
Yeah.
All right, cool. Can I get a tape of it off you, actually? That'd be good.
No bother.
That'd be good.
Shh. Don't tell the Rozzers.
In the first panel of page 13, the Sandman is operating his equipment and saying, I've rarely seen the likes of this. Kids all over the Cape Kennedy area with the same nightmare. What do you make of it, Brute? And he turns to the two scary guys in the glass canister. Brute yells,
let me out! Let me out! Blow your hypnosonic whistle and let me out!
To which Sandman says, no! The whistle is for emergencies, when I need you. Right now, I don't want you messing up the situation. To which Glob says,
look, Sandman, it's the same dream little Jed had.
Which obviously means that all these kids are having dreams of the werblink rampaging around chasing them or chasing members of their family. Very scary. In panel 3, Sandman grabs hold of a bar and swings himself up to a hole in the side of his machine that is labelled ejector tube. Kind of like when the interceptor pilots and UFO launch themselves to their vehicle.
Yes.
And as he sweeps himself into this hole, he's saying, that's right, Glob. I better get over there and see what gives. The caption for panel 4.
The Sandman hurls himself into his dream ejector tube and is instantaneously transmitted to the mortal world.
Fantastic. Yes, we see the Sandman with his cape billowing behind him, dropping onto the ground near, well, very helpfully, he thinks where he is. Cape Kennedy! Great heavens! It's an earthquake! Yes, we can see it like, looks like massive distortion energy clouds, almost virtually Kirby dots, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Is this the first proper Kirby dots we've had in this issue? I think it is. The next panel, we can see all hell is breaking loose. Buildings toppling over, people on the ground, policemen and firemen doing their work, firemen firing hoses onto burning buildings. Sandman lifts up an officer who's obviously in trouble, carries him over his shoulder thinking, the secret defence installations, up in flames! I gotta help these poor people. This is brilliant. First panel of page 14, we see the Sandman standing with firemen around him, fire engines, a couple of police officers, a couple of firemen. One cop says,
who's the guy in the strange outfit?
The fireman says, I don't know, but he sure looks suspicious. Another policeman points at Sandman and says,
you there, how'd you get here?
Never mind that. And he points to the man that he's just been helping, who's down on the ground in front of him and says, this man is suffering. Get a doctor to give him something to stop the pain. But the policeman says,
can't be done. There aren't enough doctors here.
Then I'll help him, says the Sandman. And the caption for panel 4 of page 14 reads,
the Sandman's fingers fly to his belt and remove a sand cartridge.
Yes, we get a close-up of the detailing of his belt, sort of weird hexagon shapes, red hexagons against black, and he's lifting one of the hexagons out. It's obviously a little cartridge, which he opens up in the final panel of page 14 and scatters the contents, which look like just like sand and dust, over the man on the ground. As he does this, Sandman says, he'll sleep now. And one of the cops says,
he's throwing sand in the man's face. Stop him.
In the first panel of page 15, one of the cops pulls a gun on Sandman, saying,
"Don't make another move, mister."
The fireman behind him says, "Keep him covered, officer. He may be a firebug." As he says this, we see the Sandman still has the cartridge in his right hand. In panel 2, he swings the cartridge towards the cop and the fireman, unleashing more sand. And as he does this, Sandman says, "Sorry, I've got too much to do." And we see the policeman doubling up as the sand drifts into his face, saying,
"That sand, it's putting me to sleep."
And in panel 3, he's out for the count down the grass. And the fireman says, "They've fallen asleep. Both of them are sleeping." And at that, with Kirby dots and flames crackling all around him, the Sandman leaps off. Take a drink for the next panel, listeners. There's a full moon hanging in the background as we see the Sandman sprinting along past a palm tree, which is pretty cool. As he goes, he thinks, "Little Jed had the same dream those other kids had. There's some connection between that whirlblink of his and the destruction at the Cape." And in the final panel, page 15, he comes across, well, very helpfully, he thinks, it's the boy, Jed, and the doll. And we see Jed holding up the whirlblink, which is obviously in a very sorry state. And Jed is saying,
"Whirlblink, whirlblink, my poor little friend, what have they done to you?"
And things start getting really weird in the next page, listeners. Top of page 16, a very thick-fingered hand rests suddenly on Jed's shoulders, and a voice says,
"We'll take the whirlblink, boy."
Jed looks around and says,
"What?"
And in panel 2, we see that he's struggling with what looks like a comic book caricature version of a World War II Italian army officer. Jed yells,
"No, no, it's mine!"
And we also see, walking up behind this figure who Jed's struggling with, a sort of caricatured version of a World War II comic book Nazi and a caricatured version of a World War II, I'm guessing, Japanese officer. The German caricature is saying, "That little spine may be trouble. We'd better take him along too." However, the caption for panel 3 reads,
"The next moment..."
Thankfully, the Sandman has appeared. With a cry of, "Let him go," he unleashes a massive punch which seems to send all three of the military figures flying. The Japanese one cries,
"Hey!"
In the next panel, the Italian seems to regroup and says,
"Stop him, I'll do something."
And behind him, we can see an approaching vehicle as the German cries, "Here's the Jeep, run him down." And in the final panel, page 16, there is a massive crunch sound effect as the Sandman gets struck by the Jeep. Gosh, that's a brilliant panel. That's very iconic. You can imagine Roy Lichtenstein ripping that off and selling for millions. The caption for the first panel on page 17 reads,
"Later that night, in the back room of a doll repair shop on the mainland beyond Dolphin Island..."
Back room of a doll repair shop supported menswear at one of their first gigs in Camden, I believe.
I thought that's where they played one of their first gigs in Camden.
What, in the back room of a doll shop? Yep. It's possible. You know what they were like? Listeners, I'm going to endeavour to get a member of menswear to come onto the podcast one day and have a chat. Wouldn't that be fun? Anyway, yes, in the back room of this doll repair shop, we can see some gurneys, some beds stretched out, and also ranged all over the place are a number of Whirlblink lookalike dolls. General Electric is there wearing a sort of surgical smock. We can see the female Whirlblink that he was working on earlier lying on one of the beds, and the caricature German, Italian and Japanese officers have walked into the room, the Japanese one bearing Jed's Whirlblink. The Italian officer says,
"Hail, General Electric, we've got the lost Whirlblink."
To which the Japanese officer says,
"It is broken, but still functioning."
And then General Electric says,
"Put it here on the operating table."
In the next panel, we see that Jed and the Sandman have been brought along, both tied up with ropes, securing their arms to their back, etc. General Electric says,
"You brought the child too. Good. We shall have to do away with him."
Indicating the Sandman, the German officer says, "This one tried to stop us. He fights like a Nazi tank." General Electric says,
"Who are you? Why are you trying to interfere?"
"I am the Sandman, Weaver of Dreams. I knew you wouldn't believe me."
"It doesn't matter. Let the Sandman watch the destruction of his land as we watch the destruction of ours."
General Electric there, Sandman says in reply to him, "You mean the Axis powers? Germany and Japan? Why, that was almost 30 years ago. Close-up of General Electric rounds out page 17 as he says,
"For 30 years we have lived with our wounds and deformities because of your war machines. Now we have the chance to strike back."
"You're mad. All of you." And in the first panel of page 18, with a crack sound effect, General Electric viciously punches the Sandman, saying,
"Mad? How can I be mad? My brain is an electronic instrument capable of precise computations and devoid of pity or compassion."
In the next panel, we see him with two electrical leads by the looks of things, as if he's about to connect them. And as he's doing this, he's saying,
"That's why I shall succeed in our ultimate vengeance. Now see how the computerized warp links are to be linked. When these two wires are connected, it will release electric charges planted in your nation's capital."
And as the camera pulls out for panel three, we can see that the two warp links, Jed, so the one that was all broken up, and the female one that General Electric was building, lying on their gurneys, the red leads coming out of them, and General Electric fastening them together. He continues,
"It will blow that city to eternity."
Sandman, still down the ground, still bound by his ropes, watches this and thinks, "If I could only get out of my supersonic whistle to release Brute and Glob." Helpfully, in the next panel, we see the Germanic officer reaching down and saying, "What's this in this fine's glove?" And we see him pulling something out of Sandman's glove. Off camera, one of the other officers says,
"A whistle. What does it sound like, Hans?"
"It's weird. I've never heard a sound like that, except in my dreams," says Hans the German. We can see the swastikas very clearly as he blows on the whistle, and we get a nice little jagged burst of yellow energy. One of the other officers says,
"Ugh, it's making me sleepy."
And another one remarks,
"Me too."
Yeah, the effects of the whistle. A small caption tells us we're continued in the fourth page following. We pass adverts, full page adverts for the tabloid reprint of Action Comics number one. And
lovely.
For that nice Batman one when he's running through the desert.
Mm.
Pass the full page advertisement for such things as the monster ghost, the X-ray specs, and the skinhead wig. Not that I need one of those.
7 foot monster. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
See behind glasses.
Muscles of steel. I've got those.
There you go.
By definition, we arrive at the top of page 19 where the first caption reads,
"In the Dream Dome, the tubes holding Brute and Glob are opened by the ultrasonic vibes."
Ultrasonic vibes, that's the best kind of vibes. Yes, we see that Brute and Glob have been released. We get a better look at them now that they're out of the canister, and we see that Brute wears boots and has sort of blue trunks and is a bit more fleshy in tone. But Glob is hideous, horrible, like kind of like MODOK in a way, kind of just this grey lumpen head with arms and legs.
Like a naked MODOK.
Naked MODOK. That's a good name for a band, isn't it? Anyway, they seem to be running from the Dream Dome and along a sort of path of yellow electricity. Glob is carrying a sack, a little sack, you know, Hessian sack in his right hand, and he's saying,
"Sandman must need us. Have you got your bag of vile things?"
"I am a vile thing. Come on. Let's ride the sound waves to where the Sandman's at."
So that's what it was. It's the sound waves generated by the Sandman's whistle. Tremendous. Caption for panel two of page 19.
Brute and Glob arrive at their destination in the twinkling of an eye.
And we see them poking through the window of the room where General Electric is doing all his work. We can encourage you to take a drink because we can see a full moon behind them. They're opening up their little bags that they're carrying. We can see weird shapes inside as they open them up. Brute is saying,
"Okay, Glob, release your pets."
"Gotcha, Brute."
And the caption for panel three reads,
"The Axis veterans put to sleep by the whistle are tormented by violent, horrible nightmares."
Yes, the contents of Brute and Glob's sacks are revealed to be rats and giant insects and spiders that all start crawling across the floor towards the three officers. The German one screams, "Ah, take them away!" The Japanese one yells,
"Save me! Save me!"
But General Electric doesn't seem to be fazed by this. He's watching all this going on and he says,
"Wake up, you imbeciles! What's wrong with you? What are they seeing?"
And the caption for panel four reads,
"General Electric is unaffected by the whistle's sonic wavelength. He quickly arms himself and seizes Jed."
Yes, he's got a weird Jack Kirby-style gun in his hand, which he's now pointing at Jed's head. Jed has gone blonde from the shock. General Electric says,
"Who's in this room? My electronic circuits can pick you up. Show yourselves, or I'll kill the boy."
You see in the next panel that Brute is starting to undo the ropes that were securing the Sandman. He says,
"He doesn't see Glob and me, Sandman. I'll untie you."
In the foreground, we see Glob, who's saying,
"I found Sandman's whistle. Shall I blow it?"
And Sandman says, "Yes, Glob, but turn up the sonic pitch. Turn it to its highest." Can you guess what's going to happen next, listeners? Place your bets now. Let's have another werewolf break moment. And indeed, as Glob blows the whistle in the first panel of page 20, we see the now familiar yellow radiating waves of sonic energy. General Electric drops his gun, clutches his head, saying,
"Sound waves hammering at my head!"
And the caption for panel 2 of page 20 reads,
"In the next instant, General Electric's glass skull shatters under the sound pressure."
Oh my goodness, there is a massive POW sound effect and glass and bits of electronic brain fly everywhere. Thankfully we don't see it. Sandman reaches towards Jed saying, "This way, son, let's get out of here." And the caption for panel 3 reads,
"The sonic waves scream out of control until the doll shop explodes."
The Doll Shop Explodes, that's a good name for a band.
Yes.
Nothing like something stolen from a comic panel which I can't remember the source of right now.
Daredevil, the teardrop explodes.
Yes, I can picture it. For some reason I thought it was Silver Surfer, probably because the teardrop was silver.
Ah, yes.
Yes, anyway, that's a story for another podcast. Yes, panel 3 shows the Sandman with Jed under his arm leaping to safety as the Doll Shop blows up behind him. In panel 4... Sandman is untying the ropes that were around Jed. Sandman is saying, "That does it. This night's bad dream is over. Now, where's that team of nightmares I know and love?" To which Jed says,
Who are you talking about? I don't see anybody."
The caption for the next panel reads,
"Nearby."
Yes, we see Brute and Glob poking their heads round a corner. Brute is saying,
"Here we are, Sandman. A jump ahead of the fireworks."
Glob holds something up and says,
"I saved your whistle too. It was fun using it."
Two nightmares cross over to Sandman and Jed with Brute saying,
"We're ready to return to the Dream Dome, Sandman."
"Right, Brute. Goodbye, Jed. You'll be all right now. This will soon fade away like any other dream." As he says this, Sandman shakes Jed's hand. Caption for the next panel reads,
"Then Sandman blows his sonic whistle."
And a little radiating wave of yellow energy emerges as he says, "Now to ride the sound waves, back to base."
In a flash, the trio vanishes into the stars.
And we see them running along the jagged yellow wave of sound through space with planets and all sorts of things radiating around them as a tiny caption reads,
The end.
And another caption follows that up saying,
"There are millions of stories in this strange, unexplained world of your dreams, and the Sandman knows all of them. Would you like to read more? Right, the Sandman, National Periodical Publications, 75 Rockefeller Plaza, New York, NY 10019.
After 6 p.m., NY 10020.
Address may now be out of date."
Yes. Listeners, write to that address and let us know how you got on. Well then, I loved that. I nearly swore.
That was blooming excellent.
I loved that. I cannot think the last time I enjoyed a comic that we did so much. That was phenomenal. Just mental.
Yeah. Ridiculous, action-packed, crammed with ideas. So many ideas.
Mm-hmm.
It's sensational. General Electric, what?
I know.
Madness. And he's not even interested until halfway through the story.
Yes.
The almost silent page of Grandpa smashing up the Werblink and then, of course, Grandpa burying it. It's, oh, just sensational stuff.
I want to know if the man in the boat who drowned at the start with the Werblink, was he in on it? Did he know what General Electric was up to? And was he trying to get rid of the Werblink so they couldn't use them? Was that what it was, do you think?
I think he was. That makes sense, yeah. I mean, the actual plot of the Werblinks being connected and it's going to blow up Washington, what? Where'd that come from?
Yeah, that's great. I mean, that to me, that's what I was thinking. Like, this guy must have been a part of it, or yeah, must have been maybe one of the policemen there, or something, and, mm-hmm, and it, one of the MPs, and he found out what was going to try to escape. Mm-hmm. And it's weird how they don't really explain that, but it's kind of implied, mm-hmm, maybe, by the use of the Werblink and how,
yeah,
it looks as though it seems to be watching and it's very alert.
Uh-huh. Wow.
This is crazy. I mean, this is probably the best point to talk about, the fact that this version of the Sandman and, mm-hmm, Brute and Glob were obviously revived and used and introduced during the Doll's House arc of Neil Gaiman's Sandman.
Yes.
I was saying to Peter before we started recording that I have very clear memories, summer of 1994, when I first started reading Sandman when I was working at Stateside Comics. Mm-hmm. This was when I bought my copy of the Kirby Sandman issue 1, and I remember reading the Doll's House and getting the Kirby Sandman and just... Yeah. In many ways, it was like when I first started reading DC Comics in the wake of the crisis and trying to map all the differences, uh-huh, and what had changed. It was fascinating trying to reconcile this with what Gaiman was doing.
Yeah.
Obviously, we're not going to go into too much detail about what Neil Gaiman was doing, but I imagine, mm-hmm, most people that listen to this podcast have read those stories. With all that in mind, within the Sandman, the Gaiman Sandman, it was all sort of fiction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a great way of sort of maybe retroactively explaining the really heightened quality of the Simon and Kirby approach.
Yes, without a doubt. As I was saying, you know, it is like a child's idea of the action hero. It is, you know, it's, mm-hmm, pure action adventure. It's high drama, it's melodrama, it's everything. And even the even his weapon, it's a whistle.
Yes.
It's something any kid could pick up and just play.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. A whistle and a bit of sand.
Yeah, aye. I mean, it's on a lot of levels, it's so different from the Wesley Dodds Sandman. Yeah. There's not a single reference to him. Mm-hmm. There's nothing in this story that says that it takes place within the DC universe at all.
Nope, keep its own earth entirely.
That's an important mm-hmm. thing to consider, I think, with all this sort of stuff. Because obviously, as we say, these characters were factored into the continuity in Sandman. But before that, mm-hmm. they're also factored in, just as getting ahead of things here, in Wonder Woman and then in Infinity Incorporated. We will cover some of that, but not for a very long time.
Yes.
This is almost like, it's like it's a Simon Kirby creation that's just completely separate from everything else that DC are doing.
It's almost like it could have slotted into one of the first issue specials.
Yes, very much so.
It's one of the tryouts almost. Yeah, it feels like it's one of those.
Uh-huh. It almost, you know, in, you know, the way that so much of the Fourth World stuff doesn't really feel like it's part of the main DCU. It's only the Jimmy Olsen stuff that kind of crosses over with it.
Yeah.
There's no indication what Earth this is taking place or anything like that whatsoever. Uh-huh. It's so separated and distant and so different from everything else that we've done.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I said at the top that I struggled with Kirby's Eternals. This is much, to me, much more readable. It almost feels, in some ways, you know, you were sort of saying like a child's nightmare. In some ways, it's very, very simplistic.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
There's some complimentary captioning and visuals, but at the same time, some of the ideas and some of the visuals are very sophisticated.
Mm.
There's quite a surreal feeling to it. This is,
without a doubt.
This is what I said about the Kirby stuff being very hit and miss.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes it lands very well. For me, this lands completely. This is phenomenal. I could read this again and again.
I mean, right now I'm looking at that double page spread that's across pages 2 and 3.
Yeah.
And although it's a double page spread, it's not the entire pages. It's like 2/3 panels at the top.
Yes.
And it tells you everything you need to know about it straight away.
Yeah.
You've got this heroic-looking character in a base. He's got all these monitors. He's obviously monitoring dreams.
Yes.
It even says Universal Dream Monitor. It's in big, bold letters at the front of it. And you've got these two hideous creatures who are asking to basically get out of these glass tubes that they're being held prisoner in, held hostage in. You don't know. They look hideous.
Yeah.
So it's fascinating.
There's so much to interpret and to get out of each, you know, almost each thing that's been shown. Like, obviously, around this time, Kirby's doing Commandy at DC, and I'm sure, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm sure there's some sort of convoluted thing published in the future that ties Jed into Commandy or something. I can't remember.
All right, okay.
Pete and I have said in the past that once we get to our end point, that there's some stories after the crisis that we might touch on.
The crisis hangover.
Yeah, we might touch on them now. I mean, because obviously this version of the Sandman, or this look of this version of the Sandman, mm-hmm. was also used in the Geoff Johns JSA series.
Yep.
Again, to tidy up storylines from the tail end of Infinity Incorporated.
Yeah.
There's so much more that we could say about these stories, but we don't really kind of want to preempt anything we might talk about in the future.
That's very true.
But I'm sure a lot of our listeners will be familiar with them, and mm-hmm. hopefully they'll enjoy the sort of journey as we come along. Pete and I sort of discussed how we were going to do this series. Listeners, you know, we'd be interested to know what you think we should do. Should we read every issue of this series, or should we just do a sort of one where we talk about the other few issues when we just sort of summarise them? At the moment, after reading this one, I'm veering towards us reading them all properly. I don't know.
Says the man who wants to clear as quickly as possible to Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Yeah, I know.
Let's slot in another 5 episodes as opposed to 1.
Yes, I know. But I don't know. Well, I think what we'll do is we'll probably read them through ourselves and talk about it and see if it's...
Well, the creative teams change throughout the series.
Yes.
Obviously, the letter writing campaign was successful when they decided to turn Sandman into a series.
Yeah.
But this is the only one that's written by Joe Simon and drawn by Jack Kirby. It's actually the final collaboration between the two of them.
Yeah.
That was, which is incredible. Yeah. And it's a standalone adventure story, which we both loved. It's packed with action, packed with adventure. It's exciting, it's gripping. I ask so many questions.
Yes, none of which are really answered.
And leaves the reader desiring a lot more.
Yeah.
Which is what you want from a comic. It really is.
Yeah, and you know, as you're saying about the changing creative teams, Kirby comes back for some of it.
Mm-hmm.
And he draws some of them. I think he does covers for all of them.
Yeah.
I kind of really want to do the rest of these. I think we're going to have to, but we're not going to let the listeners decide, but we can certainly let the listeners let us know what they think.
Yes.
At the back of issue 1, there's a big, long, full-page text piece which reads the stuff of which dreams are made. We're not going to read it, but we will post it on the Facebook page and on Instagram and X, so you can read it yourself, just to plug out the bonus features. But yes, Pete said this first issue obviously did well enough. There's an edition of Back Issue magazine which deals with the 70s Bronze Age Kirby stuff.
Yeah, issue 131, folks, check it out.
Yeah, there's an article which covers this series. There's quite a lot of preamble about other previous Sandman stories beforehand and quite a lot of preamble of what they do with them afterwards, but they sort of report that the sell-through for this one shot and the way that they could sort of work out sales figures in those days was apparently very good, so which is why they continue to do some more. But it's nearly a year before issue 2 is published, so it's quite a way off before they get some more. But issue 2 does have some letters and some blurbs and stuff that deal with issue 1. So shall we dive into that now, Pete?
Yes. Let's see if everyone else was enthused as we were.
There's a big, long preamble before the correspondence, so I'll read that now. The letters page is named Dream Dome, so that's quite good. Cool. That's quite fun. And the text at the start reads, "That first issue of Sandman was planned as a one-shot special to give our fans a look at what the famous Joe Simon, Jack Kirby team would look like in the 70s, 20 years after their last co-appearance. We never imagined that there'd be a second issue. It was during the worst part of the paper shortage, and both Simon and Kirby were far too wrapped up in their own projects to add any additional magazines to their workloads." Yeah, there was a paper shortage because of all those 100-pagers. That's why. I re-listened to that episode yesterday, actually, listeners, so you should too. Anyway, the text piece continues, "Welcome to the fabulous fantasy world of the Sandman reader, or hello again to those of you who picked up the first issue of our Heroes magazine when it hit the newsstands a year ago. We also never imagined the tremendous reader reaction to that first issue, both on the newsstands and in the mails. Sandman number one sold extremely well, and we received several hundred letters. Between those two signs of success, it was obvious that the Sandman would have to return." Pete, say, I think we're going to have to do issues 2, 3, 4. I think we're going to have to do the other ones.
It looks like it, yes.
"Since both Simon and Kirby were busy, a new editor had to be chosen, and we are proud to step into that breach. We've tried to live up to the promise of issue one, and will continue to in the future. Backing us up is one of the finest creative teams an editor could ask for. Michael Fleischer, whose other writing assignments include Jonah Hex and The Spectre, Ernie Chan, whose upcoming Batman artwork will astound you, and Mike Royer, the inker of the original issue and probably the man best suited to give this mag the Kirby touch outside of the King himself. We'll have a lot more to say about all of them next issue. And now, some of the comments on issue one." The editor in question, listeners, in case you're wondering, is our old pal Joe Orlando, who's also responsible for the revival of The Spectre that we've been covering. So the first letter in issue two here reads,
"Dear editor, incredible! It was like a full-colour daydream. Every fan worth his salt has wondered how the Simon and Kirby team would look if they were working together today. Kirby's art style having matured incredibly in the last 10 years or so, and Simon, a total mystery, except editorially. And now we know. Simon's script and character were intriguing. The Sandman that he featured is probably the best of the three that DC has published, with the most appropriate set of powers and atmosphere of mystery. The use of a young child is always great for reader identification, and the nightmare creatures were also powerful devices. The plot itself was not terribly complicated, or even overly intelligent, but it did work and was fun. The same way that stories in the 40s were. Improbability, absurdity and caricature combined for an enjoyable story. Kirby and Royer produced the type of art that they've been producing for the last few years. Acceptable, but hardly the best stuff that Jack has ever done."
That's a backhanded compliment, isn't it, listeners?
"I enjoyed the acceptable artwork."
Sounds like Ian Levine. Anyway.
"Back to the letter. Still, it worked well with the script, and the design of the character was terrific. Now, if only I could have dreams like this every month." And that's from Hank Samuels from Miami in Florida.
Yes, a couple more letters. One very short one, which I'll read quickly before I read the next one. The next one, the second letter, just reads, "Dear people, great work. Let's see much, much more of the Sandman and his friends." And that's from Tim Bradshaw, Chicago, Illinois.
Yay.
I'm sure we've heard from Tim Bradshaw in the past.
Yes.
The next letter reads, "Dear editor, Simon and Kirby might have been a sensation during the 40s, but as contemporary artists, they're not too hot." Oh, okay. "Sandman number one was either intended for the very youngest readers of comics or turned out that way anyhow.
Gasp.
It's a terribly disappointing case of, my, how the mighty have fallen. Oh my goodness, okay? The script was the primary fault. Simon has not developed his writing too much since the mid-50s, whereas the rest of the industry has made enormous strides forward. His stuff really isn't any worse than it ever was. It just suffers by comparison. Kirby, on the other hand, has constantly developed. Until about 1972, when he stopped progressing and entered a static period. He remains, on some levels, one of the best in the business. But this was just not his best work. Better luck next time." And that's from Frank Gordon, Macon in Georgia. Well, that was an unexpected missive. Very brave of him to print it. I kind of know what he means, though. Because
mm-hmm.
we did, so, I mean, if you were to put this, you know, compare it to one of the Fleischer Spectre stories we've been doing.
Yeah.
I think I get what Frank was meaning. It is very simplistic. Mm. There's no sense of it being realistic or modern.
Yes.
But I think that's the whole point.
It's a fantasy. The whole thing's supposed to be absolutely fantastic in every sense.
Yeah, it's not trying to be like a realistic yeah. Batman story or yeah. Brave and the Bold or Down to Earth Green mm-hmm. Lantern, Green Arrow story. It's, mm-hmm. It is, as you say, it's a heightened dream-type yeah. fantasy.
Brut and Glob are not the hard-travelling heroes.
Exactly. Oh, there's an idea for a caricature sketch. Next time you're at a Comic Con and you've got some cash to spend to get something drawn, we need some artist pals, Peter. That's what we do. We need some artist pals that can
that's what we do.
They can knock out these concept images for us as soon as we think of them.
We should just get Brut and Glob inserted into classic, you know, two shots, you know, like Flash of Two Worlds, Brut and Glob running forward.
Yes.
Batman and Robin on that rooftop, the famous Infantino one.
That Carmine cover, yes. Green Lantern 76.
Yes.
Glob is charging his power ring and Brut smashes it or smashes the whistle or something. Yeah, I think Frank missed the point. I mean, I can understand where he's coming from, though.
Uh-huh.
It does read like a very simplistic throwback, but at the same time, there is some really sophisticated stuff going on.
Yeah, without a doubt.
General Electric, that collection of three random Axis uh-huh. officers, which you and I didn't really dwell on too much, so that's fascinating. Mm-hmm. What the heck's going on? Who's funding them? How did General Electric make contact with them to set up all this plan with the Werblinks? So many questions.
He must have used some of that Kirby machinery in his head.
Probably.
Also, we didn't mention it, but I love the wordplay of General Electric, obviously being, you know, a big massive multinational company.
Of course. Of course.
And they get away with making it a baddie in this. Fantastic.
Yeah. It's like the gag in How I Met Your Mother, mm-hmm. whenever Robin and Ted salute, whenever someone oh, yes. says something like Private Problem or
General Electric.
Because our pal Kelly's a big fan of How I Met Your Mother, so I'm forever sending her photographs of dustbins on sites that I'm working on that read General Waste. General Waste. Yeah, we could talk about this one for a long time.
Yeah. You know, one thing that I really admire DC, and in particular Joe Orlando for, is printing these negative letters.
Yes.
Because it's dead easy just to, you know, print all the good things and pretend everything's wonderful and great.
Very much.
But to actually print heavy criticism.
Yeah.
It's really bold and
yeah.
basically everyone could pile on and say, yeah, he's right, you are doing it wrong. But in a way, that's how they learn what's working and what's not.
Yeah, I mean, there's only three letters in this first text page.
And one of them's two lines.
Half of it's taken up with explanations from Joe Orlando, and one of them's
yeah.
the first couple are quite positive. But no, you're right. They're obviously doing it to kind of try and encourage debate.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about it in the past, you know, a couple of years ago now when we were doing the Kanagar Wonder Woman stories.
Oh, yes, of course.
The contemporary correspondence reminded us of, like, people commenting on Facebook or posting on Twitter.
Yeah.
This seemed like a sort of, almost a troll-like comment on an official Facebook post yeah. just designed to annoy other people.
On the old DC message boards.
No, I would not see, but the old DC message boards were always quite positive. They really were. There was not yeah. a lot of negativity. Occasionally you would get sort of, you know, blanket negativity, but generally the feeling was always quite positive. Steve would, I'm sure, agree with me. But no, it's interesting. They've obviously done that to try and generate a bit more reader response to, you know, maybe get some folk into writing in defence. It's going to be, we're going to have to do the rest of these. It's going to be interesting to see what people think. So many questions. You know, and we should also point out before we go is that it's very interesting, this Sandman story being published, because the original Sandman, Wesley Dawes, has obviously got quite a lot to do in the 1974 JLA-JSA crossover.
He certainly does.
And I almost wonder, and we'll say more, we'll probably actually, I won't say anything else on that. I'll save it till our discussions of that story. But I now have some questions in my head about that story and the way it played out and
interesting.
The rise and the wherefores. Interesting. Listeners, please get in touch and let us know what you think of the Kirby Simon 70s Sandman. How can they do that, Peter?
Well, you can email us at theearth2podcast@gmail.com. Make sure you follow us on social media because we're posting lots of lovely bonus material for this and indeed every episode on Facebook and Instagram. We're at The Earth 2 Podcast and on Twitter we're at podcast_earth2 and it's the number 2 for all of our socials.
If you're feeling generous, you could go to wherever it is you receive your podcasts and give us a positive review or even a negative constructive review if you like,
yes.
A bit like Frank Gordon's letter in this year, The Sandman.
Uh-huh.
If you're feeling even more generous, as I've said a few times recently, you can go to our coffee page and buy Peter the price of a packet of Lucozade or a couple of packets of Strepsils or some lockets or something or some soothing balm because his voice would appreciate it.
I did make it through this one.
Yes, though we've done okay. We've recorded two episodes today, so we've done very well. I think I've recorded three episodes in the past 2 days altogether because Steve and I were recording the other night as well, listeners. Ah, yes, Steve will be back to help lighten the load on our Dr. What's On So yes, all that rambling. I think we've decided we're going to do the rest of the Simon and Kirby Sandman, haven't we? I think we're going to have to, matey.
We'll read ahead and see. We'll check the quality of them.
I think no, but even if they're half as fun as this one, I think we're going to have to. And it only adds another four episodes onto the list.
Five.
That's not too bad. No, we were going to. Is there six? I thought there was five issues. Yeah, that you're right. So instead of doing one episode where we talk about five issues, we'll do another.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, it adds another four episodes to the tally. Four more than there would have been if we'd just done a summer. I want to do them. We have to. I enjoyed that a heck of a lot more than I thought we would. So yes.
Yeah, that was great fun.
Listeners, what do you think? You know how to let us know.
On that bombshell.
Indeed.
I've been Peter.
And I've been the Sandman. I've been David. We'll see you next week on
The Earth 2 Podcast.
Transmatter Cube activated. Return coordinates set for Earth Prime.
The final panel of page 3, we can see that Grandpa, I forgot his name, Ezra. I should have done his voice like the singing voice of popular chart act George Ezra. Anyway.
Or as Ezra Miller.
Hang on, sailor. No, right. That sounds rude.